On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More than 2 weeks after the Utah coal mine collapse, the six miners are still missing somewhere under 1,600 feet of mountain rock. Hope is dwindling that they'll be found dead or alive. Three rescuers are dead, more are injured. Lessons, said Utah Governor John Huntsman last week, must be learned.
All I ask is that the loss of lives and the injuries and the families that have been impacted not be in vain, that we learn something from what our state has been through that makes not just mining in our state of Utah, but throughout the country and indeed the world, better and safer. If we learn no lessons at all, I think this will have been in vain, and that is totally unacceptable.
It's early, but not too early, to look at the message of Crandall Canyon and its dead this hour on Point. Lessons from the Utah coal mine disaster about the way we mine, the way we rescue, and the real cost of coal. Joining me first today from Denver, Colorado, is NPR reporter Jeff Brady. He's just back from Utah, where he spent the last 2 weeks covering the collapse and rescue effort at Crandall Canyon Mine. Jeff Brady, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So can you bring us up to date on the status there? I mean, we saw the funeral yesterday for Dale Black, one of the rescuers, 1,000 people or so at the Little Bear Creek campground, the only place they had big enough. But what is the status of the rescue effort at this point? Is it over?
Yeah, there's a fifth hole being drilled down into that mine, about 1,500 feet or so. And as soon as that is finished, they're going to put another microphone down there, a camera down there, and also test the air. But nobody's very optimistic that anything encouraging is going to be found. Even before they get in there and look around, folks are saying they just don't expect to find anything.
Tensions high as the funerals come on now. Bob Murray, the co-owner of the mine, of course, who's been out front so much in speaking to the press and the families, had a friend of one of those dead approach him yesterday, hand him a dollar bill in kind of a fury, cold fury. Here's the money, you need to keep going. The AP reports his head snapped back as if he'd been slapped. What are the tensions about? How do you define them now around the collapse and tragedy and story, Jeff?
Yeah, and this is a big change just in the last couple of days. In these small communities, people like Bob Murray, who are, you know, a large part of the economy, they're revered and they're given a lot of latitude, and they're sort of seen as patriarchs in the community, mm-hmm. taking care of everyone. And now I think some of those people in the community are starting to feel like he wasn't taking care of them, and they're starting to turn on him, and we saw that yesterday at that funeral. That was an extraordinary display, and you just wouldn't have seen that a couple of months ago in this town because Bob Murray was an important man there.
What are the bones of contention then, Jeff? I mean, emotions are understandably high. There have been large losses here and a huge amount of attention on it. But is it about the way the mining itself was going on? Is it about the rescue effort and its failure and its cost? What?
That it's about the safety and how the mining was done, and those are where all the questions are right now. And I suspect that's going to be a large focus of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA, investigation that's going to start here pretty soon. We should get results of that in a couple of months, but there's going to be a lot of questions about who's responsible for this. Did they go too far in going back in there and re-mining areas that had already been mined, or... was it safe? And also there's going to be some questions about MSHA itself. Did it pore over that mining plan and determine that it was safe, or did it give Bob Murray a little too much latitude because of his role in the coal industry as a leader?
What is his role in the coal industry? We've seen him with his coal-streaked face giving impassioned statements outside the mine, going down into the mine, with the press going down in to try and dig out, he said, with his bare hands, the rescuers, when they were trapped or crushed and lost. But what is Bob Murray's wider role?
I kind of consider him Cole's number one cheerleader lately. You'll see him at hearings on Capitol Hill. Every chance he gets, he's gonna talk about coal. And I think it's helpful to understand where he's coming from too, because he wasn't born into some big coal family. he was born to a coal miner, and he built this business up from nothing. I mean, he's got a number of mines now, I'm sure is worth a lot of money, and that's he's a self-made man, and that gets a lot of respect in the coal community.
But now, with all that background, he's got the equivalent of miners upset, obviously, kind of spitting in his face. And what about Richard Stickler at the Department of Labor, the head there whose agency signed off on the mining plan? What's his standing now?
Oh, yeah. If you think people are mad at Bob Murray, a lot of folks are pretty angry at Richard Stickler, too, because he comes from a coal background. He was a mining executive, also someone who came up from a coal mining family to become an executive, and, of course, now a regulator. And folks are saying maybe he wasn't as rigid a regulator as he should have been. That's something that's going to get a lot of examination here in the next couple of months.
The Salt Lake Tribune quoting Debbie Hamner, whose husband, Junior Hamner, was lost in the Sago mine disaster last year, saying, "Under the Bush administration, I just feel that production is more important than human life. Bush has set the stage for all these accidents to start happening now." I mean, those are very hard words.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, certainly somebody who's coming from the coal industry, you might expect that they're going to be a little more accommodating. They're going to understand the difficulties of working under regulations. But, I mean, that's a question we've seen over and over again in the Bush administration, where folks who are inside the industry become regulators. And that's got to be a difficult position to be in.
We're going to talk with experts who know this world very well in this hour. And Jeff Brady, I hope you'll stay with us in Denver. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Reno, Nevada, Dan Taylor. He's a professor of mining engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno. Previously worked as a miner in coal and metal mines in the West. Professor Taylor, Dan Taylor, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
You and much of the world have been watching this. There are worse disasters we know, 180, 181 trapped, maybe lost in China. But this is big in the United States, and it's received a lot of attention. Just the geophysical face of it is so dramatic. Begin to walk in with us, Dan Taylor, into the lessons that you expect the mining industry and the mining oversight agencies of government to take from the Crandall Canyon tragedy.
Tom, I think the important lessons to learn here are the ones of not to rush to judgment. There is obviously a tragedy, and the people involved are so involved in the grief that you're always wanting to strike out at someone to blame. And there are a lot of easy targets. Mr. Murray's an easy target. MSHA's an easy target. And I would hope that when everything is said and done on this is that we do find out exactly what happened, if we can get back in there, and that we learn then in our operations of what's acceptable and what might not be acceptable, find out whether or not these plans were adequately vetted before they were put into place. And as the governor of Utah so aptly put it, that this tragedy would not be in vain, that we did learn something from it.
The Salt Lake Tribune, in an editorial sort of raising the big skeptical question, they say, we cannot know at this early stage whether the twin tragedies of August 6th, the initial collapse, and 16th, the rescuers killed at the Crandall Canyon mine, can be blamed on a heedless, safety-be-damned quest for corporate profits. You know, that's kind of the big boogeyman standing behind this. Dan Taylor, what about it? On its face, this retreat mining, where they've gone back into what has been described as an abandoned part of the mine to pull out the pillars that previous miners had left to hold up that section, and maybe even some of the major support walls as well, is that courting unnecessarily or unjustifiably courting danger, or is that standard procedure, or is it clear from what we know at this point?
All of the above. It is one of the more hazardous mining techniques, but it is also something that is pretty much standard operating procedure when you're trying to get the last bit of a resource out. To say that retreat mining is too dangerous to be done is a blanket statement that I think is untrue. I think, again, we have to look at the specifics of how it was being done in this case. Was it being done according to the approved plan, and was the approval of the plan appropriate for the ground conditions? I think one of the things to remember is that MSHA had been in there and inspected this operation less than a month before the cave-in, and those inspections are very detailed, and they look at the ground conditions, they look at the roof support, the bolting patterns, and the plan of operations to see if it makes sense. And coming out of that inspection, apparently there was no problem. So something else seems to have happened.
Jeff Brady, did you get the sense at Crandall Canyon that people presume that MSHA, the federal oversight agency here, will have been tough enough in its assessment of the dangers related to mining? Is that their reputation these days?
Well, I would say in the towns around Crandall Canyon Mine, folks believe that for the first week, and then we started noticing the skepticism. Everybody in town knows a coal miner, and for, you know, decades, they've been safe in these mines. And so there was a lot of trust, I think, in the regulators and the mine operators that these were safe places to be. But then as the time wore on and the rescue wasn't going very well, that's when people started asking questions and being a little more skeptical.
We're talking this hour about lessons from the Utah coal mine disaster, about the way we mine, the way we rescue or try to, and about the real cost of coal. Here's Bob Murray, co-owner of the mine, on August 7th, the day after the collapse, angrily defending his company's safety record.
And let me tell you something else. This is the first major accident I've ever had in one of my coal mines in 20 years of being in existence. The first major accident.
And he said, though it was quickly refuted by scientists, he said it was an earthquake.
This was caused by an earthquake, not something that Murray Energy or Utah American did, or our employees did, or our management did, or that the Mine Safety and Health Administration did. It was a natural disaster, an earthquake.
Jeff Brady was quickly there covering the whole scene for National Public Radio. He joins us today from Denver, Colorado. From Reno, Dan Taylor is with us, a professor of mining engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno. And right now as well, from Wheeling, West Virginia, mining country itself, David McAteer joins us, a leading authority on mine safety, former head of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration under President Clinton, MSHA. He's vice president of sponsored programs and governmental affairs. He's a legal advisor to Wheeling Jesuit University. David McAteer, thank you very much for being here.
Tom, thanks for having me.
You know, we're all getting lessons in mining and what it costs to turn the lights on out of this. Where do you think the public should be focusing its attention in the aftermath of what we've seen at Crandall Canyon, David?
I think, Tom, the lesson here, if the lesson after Sego was we needed to equip the miners so that they could stay alive for long enough for us to get to them, the lesson here is that that hasn't been done sufficiently. We haven't. We need to redouble our efforts in the area of communication. And more to the point here, though, is we need to be able to rescue people quicker and more effectively. I think the hard lesson here was we weren't in a position, we didn't have many options, we didn't have the technology to be able to get into these men quickly. Because in part of the depth, but also because of the bounces and bumps and pressures that we're seeing at this mine. We need to look at new technologies that if we're going to send miners in to these depths and into these conditions, we ought to be able to extract them safely and quickly.
Is there technology available that could have allowed the rescue effort on the surface to communicate with these men 1,600 feet beneath the surface? And if so, why wasn't it deployed?
We know that there is technology that exists that would put antennas down to the shafts or the slopes and then be wireless throughout the system. Do we know whether that would have survived the bounces and bumps? We don't know that. But what we know is we don't have it underground, so we can't tell whether or not it would have survived. There are multiple technologies that have both two-way communications now. We've looked at them. The federal MSHA agency has looked at them. NIOSH is doing a study of them. The problem is we need to have them in the mines, and we need to expedite the consideration of them. And there's no reason the companies can't put technologies underground that would give us a chance to get to them. The roof held in this case. We had air in this case. If we'd known where the miners were, we would have had a shot at getting them.
Now, do you know for sure that the roof held where the miners were? We know from digging down, I guess I should put it to you, Dan Taylor, we know from these shafts that were put down that there was clearance down there, 5 feet plus maybe, but do we know that that's necessarily where the miners were?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know exactly where the miners were.
Mm-hmm.
The rooms that they have been able to put boreholes into with the cameras appear to be there appears to be space. In cases, there was oxygen and water. Unfortunately, we haven't found the room in which the miners are at. So I think that our issue here of knowing where the miners are is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think that the research needs to be done in terms of how do we maintain communications through solid rock. And as been pointed out, there are ways to do it, but it's going to take more research, it's going to take more time, it's going to take more money. We should probably be moving faster in that direction.
Jeff Brady, there was a push for this in Congress after a spike in mining deaths last year, but not a push fast enough to get this technology deployed. Where does that stand now? Do you know, Jeff?
I haven't been following that specifically. I'm a little more focused on the Crandall Canyon mine.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks were asking in the wake of that accident, I thought we were going to have these communication devices available. Why can't you just talk to them? Other than that, I'm not sure where that law is.
Without that, very tough to find them. There was talk of a bigger borehole and putting down a capsule to pull folks out of this mine. David McAteer, should Crandall Canyon have gone to that extent? We're putting down 2-inch holes and 4 and 5-inch holes. What about a big one, big enough for humans?
The technology that we're using is technology that's somewhat dated. I don't suggest that the rescue efforts weren't desirous, and the rescuers were brave individuals, and the drillers were trying their best. What we haven't done is we haven't applied the technologies, for example, tunnel boring machines that can move with a higher speed and that can carry with them employ or put in their own protection so that you don't have to use the rescue team's efforts to try to rebuild a tunnel, but can drive a tunnel down through the earth that already has a casing that goes with it to protect it. That kind of technology we ought to have as a rescue system, and we need to be looking at, and I agree with Dan, that we need to be putting more money into the kind of technologies to be able to rescue guys in a faster way. With regard to the communications, we have followed it quite carefully, and the communication is that, but NIOSH has issued 3 contracts. Those contracts are to be returned, research returned July of 08, and then a requirement for July of 09 for two-way communication. The difficulty is we're still putting people under the ground today, and we're not putting in the technologies that we have currently available.
David McAteer, let me ask you about this Western mining. It's much deeper in general than is done in the East, way down at 1,500 feet, which was once thought to be a kind of structural limit for holding up a mine roof, and considerably deeper than that. And it's going in after these great pillars of coal that were often left by earlier mining operations. Now the price of coal is high. You know, that's been described, I'm looking here at a Washington Post story, where that's described as free coal, the cheapest coal you can get, kind of irresistible for mining companies to go in after it. But is it fair to the miners who are asked to blow out these supports and bring them up as coal? It's, you know, the mine's already dug. It's easy money if you can bring it up, I guess. But is it fair to ask miners to do that, or does it ask them to take too much risk?
Well, your question is in 2 parts. Is the Western mine different than the Eastern? And secondly, this remining issue needs to be addressed. First, there are areas in the mining community or in the United States, but around the world, where because of geologic conditions and the height of the cover, the amount of the mountain, the size of the mountain, if you would, that are prone to burst and out and burst and bumps, and these really are a sudden release of pressure that builds up as you mine. And Crandall Canyon was one of them. We know that area has been prone to bumps. The Coeur d'Alene region of Idaho, South Africa, Poland, all of these countries have areas that are more prone to bumps than others.
Bumps from earthquakes or bumps because the guts of the mountain are being moved around and hollowed out?
The bumps because there is no question this is not an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
That is
okay.
It's over. This is because of mining activity. And that's not to say that you can't handle it. That's to suggest that you need to be aware of it and you need to be preventing it from becoming a cataclysmic event. In South Africa, for example, in the gold mines, they read the pressure on gauges. When the pressure builds, they diffuse it by small explosions that allow the rock to come down and release that pressure. We haven't done that kind of technology in this country. That's the Western issue. But the second issue you raised is retreat mining or re-mining, in effect. As we grow much more mature as a mining country, we are going back into these mines where where they've been mined before, and as the article in the paper suggested, that's going after free coal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in point of fact, that panel, in this instance, was left for a reason. It was left by the previous owner for safety reasons.
The panel you're talking about is a massive amount of coal still standing there as like a structural support to the mine.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the mining occurs on both sides of that panel. Exhaustive mining called longwall mining, which basically changes the geology in the mine so that it's not like it was when it was virgin seam. It's a different geology.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing more of that in this country, as was suggested, but the problem is, is the safety caught up with that re-mining process? There may well be, and there are places where the risk is too high and you can't hold the top, or we can't prevent the kind of outburst explosions from occurring. We shouldn't be mining in certain areas. There are other areas where we can do it, and I think that's what the test has to be now. Is we've got to look at much more, building in much more protection and outlawing in some instances mining altogether when the risk is too high, and building in stronger protections when we know that we're going to encounter problems.
Dan Taylor in Nevada, how about it? Do you think that the temptation of the big profits there, the sort of free coal, as Sue Ann Martell at the Western Mining and Railroad Museum described it, are so great that it leads mining companies, tempts them to sort of play a little fast and loose with miner safety?
Tom, it hasn't been my experience that in fact happens. I mean, it's a nice thing to a nice excuse to say, well, it was corporate greed that caused us to put people in harm's way.
Well, Crandall Canyon is down. Those miners are presumably dead. They were doing retreat mining.
That's true, but miners are not going to go into a place where it's too dangerous if they know. The engineers aren't going to send them in. I don't think Mr. Murray is the kind of a person who would say, safety be damned, let's make a few more dollars on this coal. I think that there are situations where there's a judgment call, and apparently in this situation that may have been the wrong call, maybe it was too dangerous to be under there. But I don't think that the attitude that I have seen in mines that I have worked in, that I have been around, is such that we'll just send people in and we don't care about safety. I think safety is a very big concern in modern mining, and that just doesn't ring true to me.
Jeff Brady, miners won't go in if it's too dangerous. Was that the impression that you got at Crandall Canyon? Are they really in a situation to say no economically or union-wise or personally?
Well, I think the second part of what Don Taylor said there is the most important part, which is that engineers won't send miners into a place that's unsafe, and miners rely heavily on those engineers. And over the years, they've come to trust them, because even though we do hear about accidents, the accident rate has been getting better in this country. I mean, certainly compared to the beginning of the 20th century.
Until the spike last year.
Well, and that's something that's going to be questioned when folks really examine whether or not this is an industry that's been adequately regulated.
Let's go to Robert in Lowell, Massachusetts. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to know why Murray has been able to continue to practice mining with all these safety violations. If I drive my car down the road and I had as many safety violations as he does, or is he as he allegedly does, I'd have my license removed and they wouldn't let me drive.
Let's take it to the experts. Devitt McAteer, you were head of the Mining Safety and Health Administration. Is it something about Mr. Murray's record that should exclude him from mining, or is it within what's considered acceptable in mining?
Tom, it's within the norm. There are 321 violations in the last 3 years plus some months, and it amounts to about 80 violations a year. Half of those are what is called S&S, significant and substantial. It's not a record that is unusual. In answer to your caller's question, these can be considered violations which the Mine Act cites you for everything. You get cited for every particular. There are probably 15,000 regulations, and you get cited for any of these things. It's done as a precautionary measure. It's done as a prevention scheme to say, I'm going to cite you for this, I'm going to cite you for that, not to suggest that they're not. What our experience is that small matters build up to large matters, so the inspector cites you for everything. This would not be a thing like driving without headlights or a thing where you would drive without a muffler or some serious matter. This would be significant, certainly, but it would not be life-threatening events, so that his record doesn't jump out at you as having a particularly bad record.
And Devitt McAteer, what about regulation by the federal government here? Dan Taylor or Jeff Brady were saying earlier that Bob Murray's come to be seen as a big, you know, voice of the coal mining community, said to be very well politically plugged in. Do you see in this Bush administration less vigilance on regulation? There was the move to, you know, change the inspectors from regulators to compliance assistants. And all that. Do you see diminished vigilance or not?
Well, I think it has to be said, and when the administration's changed, with the new administration in 2000 said that they wanted to emphasize compliance assistance, and they said,
as opposed to oversight and regulation.
That's the implication, mm-hmm. as opposed to inspection and enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
That was a departure from the philosophy that we incorporated, which was a dual effort. One was strong enforcement, and two was compliance assistance and education. We said if we've got a problem, we're going to go in, much like we need the if the state highway troopers were taken off and they were just going to give you compliance assistance, some of us would be tempted to speed up.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem, is I think that there's a temptation to push the envelope. When you have good enforcement balanced with the compliance assistance, I think you have a better chance of having safer mines.
Jeff Brady in Denver, I know we've got to lose you in a few seconds here. Do you expect attention now to turn sort of out of the Western Mountains and toward Washington in the aftermath of these collapse?
Absolutely. I think that there's going to be a lot of focus on MSHA in coming months, and folks are going to be asking, did they do everything that they could? Did they pore over that mining plan and make sure that it was safe for those miners to be in there and make sure that the company was doing its homework? Hopefully we're going to find that out when this investigation is concluded in a couple of months.
Jeff Brady, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking this hour about lessons from the Utah coal mine disaster, about the way we mine and the true cost of coal. On Monday this week, Cody Allred, son of trapped miner Kerry Allred, said he felt like mine officials were giving up on his dad.
First, we were given a promise. Dead or alive, those men will be with their families. And now we can't. Basically, we won't.
At yesterday's funeral for Dale Bird Black, a rescuer killed last week at Crandall Canyon Mine, his daughter Ashley spoke about her father's constant hope and determination.
From the beginning of this tragic accident, my dad worked as hard as we knew he would to get those miners out of there, and he never gave up hope. There were times when he was up there that he didn't even need to be, but he just wanted to do his part in the rescue effort.
at the funeral yesterday. We've been joined in this hour by Dan Taylor, professor of mining engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno, joining us from Reno, Nevada, from Wheeling, West Virginia, by David McAteer, former head of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration under President Bill Clinton. Right now from Saratoga Springs, New York, we're joined by Jeff Goodell, journalist and author who's closely followed the coal mining industry, author most recently of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff Goodell, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Your thoughts as you watch the tragedy unfold at Crandall Canyon over the last 2 weeks?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously very moved by what these family members are saying today. And, you know, like everyone else, wondering what exactly went on here and whether this could have been avoided. You know, I think one thing that's not being discussed is, you know, the fact that, you know, coal mining, you know, that we've been mining coal for, you know, 150 years in America, and there's a big boom right now. And the simple fact is that a lot of this sort of easy-to-get coal is gone, and coal mining is getting increasingly complex and increasingly dangerous. And without tough oversight on this, I think we're going to see more of this kind of thing.
Jeff, mining deaths sound like history. They sort of have the tang of the, you know, the 19th century. But are you saying, is this the future? Are we going to have to go to greater and greater extremes to bring out the coal that's powering American power plants and turning on the lights and TV and AC?
Well, I mean, I think we are going to have to go to more extremes because, as I said, the simple, easy-to-get coal is gone in many places of the country. We're seeing it in these giant mountaintop removal mines in Appalachia where they're blasting the mountains apart to get to the coal seams that are more deeply buried. And I think you're seeing it in, you know, these going after the coal in these deep mines in Utah and places like that. I mean, I think that this kind of thing can be done and can be done in many cases safely, but it requires, you know, tough oversight and it requires, a lot of thoughtfulness and innovation and money being put into this, which I don't think is happening right now.
Is there also a kind of race underway, Jeff, between alternative energies and that push for the last, you know, ton of coal? I mean, if we don't get something else coming on stream, are we going to just push further and further out on the risk front?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, coal is sort of the default energy source in America. I mean, we have lots of it. And so, you know, it's an industry with incredible political power and industrial sort of inertia behind it. But, you know, I think that the push for renewables is really strong right now. There's a lot of money in Silicon Valley being funneled into this. And, you know, the simple fact is that coal is going to be getting more and more expensive to mine and burn as we move into the future, while renewable power is only going to get cheaper and cheaper.
But in the interim, there's that big demand. Let's go to our listeners again. Alan's calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Okay.
What do you know, Alan? Hi.
Beg pardon?
What do you know?
Well, I spent about 40 years working in mines. I worked in Honduras. I worked in South Dakota in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and the copper mines in Michigan.
That's a lot of experience. So what do you think about this situation?
Well, I tell you, you can invent anything you want, but when you put it in a coal mine, if the old miner doesn't like it, he throws it in the ditch, and that's the end of it. I got a patent on a deal with putting roof bolts in, and it cost about $250,000. I did it for U.S. Steel.
But do you think that are you saying miners who go down and risk their lives aren't willing to use technology that might make their job safer?
Well, they don't know if it's going to be safer or not. It's like anything else. I worked down there, and I worked as a miner and at Homestake down about 5,000-6,000 feet. It was better, safer there than it was at home. If you follow the rules they got and don't wander off from your partner and all that sort of stuff, you'll come up every night at the end of the shift.
Well, we pray for that. And, Alan, thanks for your call. Dan Taylor, how about it? As we go deeper and deeper, you've got something like 7 out of 10 of major coal operations in Utah now deeper than 1,600 feet. That's way down there. The The Daily Herald in Park City, Utah, describes it as being like a submarine that's gone, you know, down to the ocean floor. The pressure becomes enormous there. Is there a point at which we just can't or shouldn't go after that super deep coal?
Well, certainly there is, and that's, again, part of the engineering equation that the operations are all interested in, is when do we get into conditions that make it too unsafe? And by that I mean this. People talk about the danger in mining. A dangerous situation is when you have a hazardous situation and you're not taking all of the precautions that you have to or that are available. When it becomes too dangerous to mine, then we shouldn't be mining. But just because something's hazardous doesn't mean we can't mitigate the hazard. We're doing things with modern technology that 50 years ago people wouldn't believe we could do. And we're much more productive. We have fewer miners underground mining the same amount of coal coming out. With these modern longwall systems, and that's a technological advance in response to hazardous conditions. But there obviously becomes a point when it's not worth the risk, and it's up to all of us, the industry, the regulators, and the public, to be part of that equation and find out where that point is.
Let's go to Jane in Lake Placid, New York. Jane, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. I just want to say I'm very, very, very high on your program. It's one of the great, great parts of radio. Thank you for doing it.
Very kind.
What
do you think?
Simple question. Mm-hmm. Yes. The kind of coal. What kind of coal are they digging out there in Utah? On your program, I think I learned that there's a softer coal, which is much worse for asthmatics, which I am. That when it comes to be burned, it's not as high quality.
Yeah.
I guess we used to have what was known as anthracite, mm-hmm. and that was hard coal, and I just want to know the answer. Thank you.
We got it, Jane. Thanks, Jeff Goodell. Bituminous, I read. What does that mean in response to Jane's question?
Well, that's, you know, bituminous is the sort of most common coal. It's not the hard coal that the anthracite referred to there.
And the western mines, the mountain mines, mainly bituminous?
Yes, mm-hmm. and it's a sort of, you know, medium to high grade coal. I haven't really looked into the real details of the quality of the coal in this, but I know it's a higher grade, say, than the softer sub-bituminous coal that is mined in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, a little bit north of there.
Dan Taylor, in environmental terms, the coal coming out of the Utah mines, out of Crandall Canyon, I don't know, dirtier, cleaner, medium? How do you rate it?
As bituminous coal, it's about mid-range as far as its energy content. One of the things about the western coals as opposed to the Appalachian coals is it's much lower sulfur content and therefore takes less scrubbing to take out the sulfur dioxide, which is one of the major contributors to acid rain. So from an environmental point of view, it's kind of a mixed blessing. You have to burn more of it because it's lower energy content than anthracite, but it probably, in terms of all pollutants, burns cleaner. It's a balancing act.
Mm. And David McAteer, where do you see us going environmentally? Another part of the cost of coal as we go to greater extremes to get it, is it on balance dirtier, cleaner? Is that a factor?
Well, I think the fact is we're going to be using coal for the foreseeable future. There is a good argument to be made that we need to stop dumping carbon unrestricted into the atmosphere, and I think that's a clear issue both in this country and around the world. The issue is how do we clean up the coal, because it was one of the dirtier fuels, and how do we clean it up, and what steps can be taken to clean it up and to use the coal that we have in a better way. There are several techniques, the coal sequestration that have been used or have been studied that will help us a little bit. There are other uses, that other types of scrubbing, as Dan mentioned, that can help us a little bit. We're not going to make a quantum leap and make this stuff clean, entirely clean environmentally, but we also don't have an alternative at the moment. So what we need to do is put into play what protections we have, what improvements we have, and then work on trying to improve that further.
Let's go to Dean in Williston, Vermont. Hi, Dean. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I used to work in an auto factory. I won't mention which one it is, but I should. There was a sign up there that said no accidents, or, you know, something like that. No accidents in 230-some days.
Okay.
And while I was there, a guy who was, because they wouldn't put in a cheap on-off switch, and that's the truth, he lost his leg. And his reward for all that was they gave him a broom for the rest of his days there.
Okay.
And I don't think this is any accident. I don't think you can say, well, it's great, and they're doing everything they can. They're not doing everything they can, because people are being treated as though they are cogs in the car or rock in the mine.
And so your skepticism stays high. David McAteer,
skepticism.
Born of that experience in the auto factory. David, take us back to the Crandall Canyon mine. What do you expect is going to come out in the months ahead as the follow-up investigation goes forward? First, you know, with everything we've seen, do you assume that we'll be able to reach the site of this collapse? And then will we get a full reading, a full story out of that? I mean, I'm looking back here in the record, even before the August 6th collapse, there was a violent shift, one of these bumps that prompted mine managers to move crews away from one of the barriers that was apparently weakened. 23 more seismic events in the days, you know, leading up to the sort of lateral implosion that finally buried the rescue crew. Are we going to get the full story? Will it be dug out of the mountains here?
I think it will be difficult, because there's a real live question as to whether there will be reentry into this mine section and reentry into this section where this violent burst occurs. There is a point where you just simply have to say, we cannot get in there for whatever reason, because of the shift in the mountain and the pressures that the mountain is pressing down into the mine area. But I think the threshold questions that have to be asked are, should this plan have been approved? Two, given the fact that you had a history of outbursts recently,
mm-hmm.
Particularly within 1,000 feet of this location, should we have been taking these pillars, and should we have been retreat mining and pulling pillars out of there as a larger question? And should we be mining in certain areas where we do have this experience and proneness to having bumps? And then we're going to have to look at the question, was the plan followed? And that's, again, going to be difficult to know, because we won't have the capacity, it's likely that we won't have the capacity to get there.
Was Bob Murray going to be then to sort of get a pass here, because the evidence is buried along with the miners?
I think the questions are going to have to be asked, not just for Bob Murray, but for the kind of mining that's being conducted here and in similar mines in other parts of the country. Should we be doing this kind of mining? I think that the lesson that the governor is pushing forward and that all of us in the community hope to happen is that we learn to get our technology in there faster so that we can locate and communicate with people. Second, get a way to find a way to relieve these guys, find a way to get in and protect them. If we're going to send in people, then we ought to be able to get them out.
But that's focused on the rescue. Dan Taylor, what about the mining itself? We heard the Utah Governor John Huntsman at the top of the hour, his tape, saying very movingly, we've got to learn the lessons of this. If the cave-in is so big that we can't get back in there, will those lessons be learned? And you know, is the public right to be skeptical about the sign-off on this plan in the first place or not?
Well, that's as David's pointing out, that's going to be very tough to answer if we are not able to get back in there. But even so, I think that from an engineering point of view, what we can go back and reconstruct in a method similar to what they're doing on the I-35W bridge up mm-hmm. in Minnesota mm-hmm. is trying to reconstruct from an engineering point of view what did happen. Obviously, it would be easier if we could go in there and look at it. But still, I think that there are lessons we can learn. And maybe what comes out of this are new parameters that say, when your ground conditions are such and such, then this method is not acceptable. If your ground pressures are at such a level, if your seismic activity is at such and such a level, then this plan is not going to be valid. We don't know, of course, unless we can get back in there to determine whether the plan was being followed. But we can certainly make some decisions in the future about which plans are going to be approved.
A lot may be buried under that mountain. Jeff Goodell, you've followed Big Coal and written about it. Do you expect transparency and maybe new parameters out of this or not?
Well, you know, these mine investigations are always very political, and you know, you never get as much clarity and straightforward answers as we would all hope from them. But I would like to say that I think that, you know, the larger lesson here is not just about mine safety, but about our dependence on coal and the high cost of our dependence on coal. I mean, there's a lot of talk about coal right now, but and a lot of attempts by the industry to sort of clean it up so that it looks like a sort of viable fuel for the 21st century. But this is really a dirty, inefficient fuel contributing to many, many social and political problems.
With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Davitt McAteer in Wheeling, West Virginia. Thank you very much, Mr. McAteer, for being here.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
And Dan Taylor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Professor Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.